This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It's become a tradition on this program to look back at the end of the year and reflect on some of the stories we've reported on: the war in Iraq, presidential elections in this country, in Afghanistan and Ukraine, genocide in Sudan and terrorism at a school in southern Russia, hurricanes in Florida, and now a tsunami. 2004 also saw the Boston Red Sox reverse the curse and the Olympic Games return to Greece. We all saw Janet Jackson's wardrobe malfunction, and millions of us went to see The Passion of the Christ, Fahrenheit 9/11, and Shrek 2. The report of the September the 11th Commission hit the bestseller list, and Brood X cicadas performed their 17-year swarm. Today we'll revisit a few stories and check in with a few former guests, like the postal worker in Florida whose home was destroyed by Hurricane Charlie. And, of course, we want to hear from you. Call in and tell us about the stories that have dropped back below the radar this past year. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. But first, an update on the overwhelming story of 2004. The numbers in the Indian Ocean tsunami are staggering. 117,000 dead, 500,000 injured, 5 million in urgent need. Reporter Laura Womack joins us now by phone from Cuddalore, a small village in southeast India. And it's good of you to stay up and speak with us.
Thanks for having me, Neil.
Amid all of this crisis, there was a panic in India earlier today. Tell us about that.
Well, I was actually on the beach road headed from Chennai to Pondicherry in northern Tamil Nadu when I noticed that villagers along the coast were panicking, women were crying, there were lots of cattle being led away, goats being led away, and children being dragged by their parents inland. We pulled over and asked what was going on, and they had just had the news from the police that there was another tsunami expected and that the beach should be evacuated.
What turned out to happen?
Well, not much. The government of India had received news that there had been another earthquake, a large one, and they issued a warning, and this became generally known. They had sort of secretly, or quietly, I should say, asked officials to clear the beaches. This slowed recovery efforts somewhat for a couple of hours, but word got out, and there was across the country, and apparently there was a bit of a panic as people throughout India tried to contact their loved ones in the area. Bless NPR, they called me and asked me to get off the beach road. That was the scene. But in the end, there was no tsunami, and things have gone back to normal, or normal as they are now, which means trying to deal with the magnitude of this horror.
And, well, thank heavens it was a false alarm, but nevertheless, I guess it doesn't help. Where you have been, have you been able to see whether aid is being able to reach people, whether it's from the Indian government or NGOs or from the outside?
Well, I have very positive news to report on that score, Neil. I have not been to Nagapattinam, which is the very worst hit in this state. But in some of the other areas, the aid has been very free-flowing. Not only has the government, both nationally and locally, set up checkpoints and distribution points for aid and brought in supplies, NGOs have also contributed. Local charities have brought supplies down to people. And even small businesses and individuals have pulled together, collected goods, and distributed them. There's been a little bit of a problem with that in that it hasn't been wholly a coordinated effort, and there, in some regions, people have complained that the same people are receiving supplies and others are not getting them. It's possible that the people who are not getting the supplies are being hampered by poor access due to damaged roads and infrastructure that makes it difficult for emergency workers and transportation of supplies into those areas.
Well, let's hope that the reports from elsewhere around the Indian Ocean are equally positive. Laura Womack, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Laura Womack joined us by phone from Cuddalore, a small village in southeast India. Stay tuned to NPR News for continuing coverage of the crisis in the Indian Ocean areas. Much more on this later today on All Things Considered from NPR News. Now let's turn to some of the other major events of the past year. Of course, one story that dominated the news in this country was the presidential election. A couple of memorable lines from the candidates. Here first, Senator John F. Kerry talking about America's safety during his speech at the Democratic National Convention in Boston.
Well, if George Bush wants to make national security the central issue of the campaign of 2004, I have three words for him that I know he understands. Bring it on!
President Bush, as it turned out, did want to make national security the issue. Here he is talking about it during the first presidential debate at the University of Miami in Coral Gables, Florida.
Of course we're doing everything we can to protect America. I wake up every day thinking about how best to protect America. That's my job.
Joining us now to look back at some of the major news stories of 2004 is John Micklethwaite, U.S. editor for The Economist, co-author of The Right Nation, Conservative Power in America. He joins us by phone from Shropshire in England, and it's nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation, John.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
We've asked our listeners the last couple of days to send in emails on the stories they wanted to see followed up from the past year, and I have to say the largest number of emails we've gotten is about what people say is irregularities in the vote in Ohio. A recount's going on. What's happening with that, John?
Well, the latest figures show the latest recount, or the only official recount, shows that Bush's vote was exaggerated by 300 votes. But he's still got a lead of about 118,000. And I know there are various kind of court cases pending about different bits. But my general impression is there is a degree of exaggeration about this. You can read very, very long stories and discover at the end they're arguing about 35 votes in some fairly obscure county in Ohio. By most normal measures, Bush, rightly or wrongly, won Ohio quite straightforwardly. So I don't think that really you're going to get the same degree of after effect about Ohio as you did about Florida. But there's always a chance that it'll kind of live on in the mythology.
And, of course, we want to hear from all of you listeners. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is TOTN at NPR.org. Here's another email. We got this from Rebecca Inglefield in Hickory, North Carolina. What's going on when William Kristol, inserting parenthetically the editor of the Weekly Standard, criticizes the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld? Does it have to do with the split between the two wings of the neoconservatives? If not, then what does it mean?
Well, that's now you're dealing in the sort of, it's a bit like Kremlinology, when you used to look at the Kremlin and try and work out who was in and who was out. But basically, within the conservative movement, Rumsfeld has never really been a neoconservative in the same way as Bill Kristol is. Bill Kristol, son of Irving Kristol, brought up very much within the neoconservative tradition. And the one thing which the neoconservatives, who've taken a lot of rap over the Iraq war, often deservedly, the one thing they've gone on right from the very beginning was they really criticized Rumsfeld's idea that you could do it with relatively few troops. And that is a large part of they regard Rumsfeld as the man who messed up their dream. And that explains some degree of the schism between the two. Rumsfeld never really, he was always what they call a sort of conservative realist. He never really went along with these sort of dreamy visions of democratizing the Middle East. It's very difficult to imagine Rumsfeld sitting there, sort of sitting with his pipe and smoking it and dreaming up new and wonderful ideas in the Middle East in the same way as the neoconservatives rightly or wrongly did. And I think if you see what Kristol and other people have been doing attacking Rumsfeld, it's very much from that type of angle.
And yet, with 9 of 15, I think, Bush cabinet members replaced for the second term, Mr. Rumsfeld is not among them.
Well, he's a lucky man in many ways. It's been a pretty rotten year for Rumsfeld, if you think about it. He had Abu Ghraib, he's had the continuing disaster in Iraq, and then it ends with the stuff about him failing to sign the letters. I mean, I worked for The Economist, a magazine which called for him to resign straight after Abu Ghraib, even though we supported the Iraq war. And I think he's just had a very rough time. The latest sort of rumors seem to indicate that Rumsfeld asked for two more years at the Defense Department, and the Bush people have said you're getting one maximum. But I think there was even a possibility he might have gone after the signature incident, except in rather macabre way. I think the attacks at Mosul bolstered his position, because I don't think the one thing the Bush administration would never want to be seen to be doing would be cutting and running in front of a sort of terrorist onslaught.
Let's get some listeners on the line right now. Barry's with us from Long Island in New York.
Hi, good afternoon. I just wanted to point out the fact that, you know, a lot of the TV coverage of the war has shown these young Marines, but I also want everybody to know that five of my friends, 57-year-old grandfathers, all Vietnam veterans, were activated and are now, some of them in Kuwait and in Iraq, serving the country once again after some of them have over 38 years of service in the Guard and active duty. And the other thing is, they were activated in May of 04. They're in Kuwait. That's 8 months they've been activated. Their time, their clock, their 12-month clock in Iraq still does not start until their boots on the ground in Iraq. So they'll have a minimum of 20 months of service before they're out again. It's just a reflection of the situation of our military right now.
John Micklethwaite, the strain on the entire U.S. military, but specifically the Guards and Reserves, has been a continuing story through this year.
Story. And it's not just the Guards, it's Reserves, it's people like the sheriff's deputies have been sent out there. There are people, there are vast areas of America which have just been losing people to just simply by sending people out there to go and do jobs which they'd never really expected to end up doing. I think the kind of one of the great lessons of this year, if the previous year you saw a fantastic display of American hard power, you saw the basic demolishment of Saddam Hussein's regime. What it's shown in some ways is the American army is extremely good at pushing people over. But in the bigger business of trying to rebuild countries, you need even more people. And that is much, much more difficult. And the American army, the most mighty army on the face of the planet, is still in difficulty trying to do that. And I think there's two issues. One is the size of the force. But then the other issue, I think, is basically a rather cruder one. I think the American army is good at beating people at war. It's less good at the whole kind of peacekeeping side of it. And that is a thing which has come up repeatedly in Iraq. And trying to get those two things through is very, very difficult. But what so far has come through and which was shown again in the election is the degree to which the areas where troops come from, particularly the South, particularly sort of more militaristic states, people there are prepared to take quite a lot of, they've been very loyal, very patriotic so far, and I'm sure that will continue for quite some time, but at some point they will want to see something rather solid for it, and that's why the elections next month are so, so important.
Barry, thank you for the call, and Happy New Year.
Same to you, thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's talk now with Duke, and Duke is calling from Jacksonville, Florida.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question, and I'm sure it's pressing upon everybody. It's the fact that where's Osama bin Laden, and where's the actual, I guess, pursuit of him? And I'll take my question off the air, but, you know, that seems to me the biggest question.
Duke, thanks for the call, and Happy New Year to you. John Micklethwaite, the search for Osama continues.
It continues, and as far as we know, he's somewhere in sort of northern Pakistan, close to Afghanistan. But beyond that, that sounds almost worryingly precise. But the truth is that he's very, very difficult to find. I think the interesting thing, looking back at 2004, is the way that particular thing never really got into the election. Kerry played repeatedly the idea that Bush had been inefficient in terms of trying to winkle bin Laden out at the very last moment in Tora Bora, by relying on hired hands rather than sending American troops in. And there was, I think, a measure of truth in that. But the crucial factor is that Kerry, I think, was unable to persuade the American people, and particularly to persuade conservative America, that Bush had done something fundamentally wrong. I think more generally what Bush was able to do was, going back to the previous caller again, was that he managed to persuade people that fundamentally the war in Iraq was part of the war on terror, just as much getting rid of Saddam Hussein, trying to establish democracy in the Middle East, was just as big a part of the goal as trying to capture bin Laden. But it's certainly true that not having captured bin Laden is a serious embarrassment. I don't think he actually has, and this is an area where I'm certainly not an expert, but talking to people who are, I think it's difficult to say that bin Laden has much operational control of al-Qaeda, but he obviously exerts an enormously influential kind of spiritual effect on the whole organization.
John Micklethwaite.
Announcements which matter.
John Micklethwaite, thank you very much, and a Happy New Year to you.
Thank you very much.
John Micklethwaite, U.S. editor for The Economist magazine. He joined us by phone from England. More after a break as we focus on sports, arts, and culture. Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today about some of the stories of 2004 that sort of fell beneath the radar after popping up. If you'd like to join our conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. And in the world of sports, there was one overwhelming story this past year.
Back to full. Red Sox fans have longed to hear it. The Boston Red Sox are world champions.
For the first time in 86 years, joining us now is Joe Queen, an author most recently of Queen and Country, a reluctant Anglophile's pilgrimage to the mother country, and a resident of Westchester County in New York. Joe, good to have you back on the show.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
So for a Philly fan, how about those Red Sox?
I think everybody was happy to see the Red Sox win, except, of course, the 20 million people who root for the Yankees in New York and the 80 million people from other parts of the world who are front-running Yankees fans. And I think that it's still fascinating that, particularly in New York, New York Yankees fans still don't understand why everybody was so happy about the Red Sox winning. And, you know, there's a certain element where we'll let the other team win once every 86 years. It's only fair.
And, of course, now they've gone on to ensure that everybody else still hates them by pursuing Randy Johnson, probably the best pitcher in baseball.
Well, I think that the national sport is no longer baseball. The national sport is watching as George Steinbrenner figures out a way to spend even more money and not win the World Series, which is in a kind of an exhilarating experience. But I think one of the most telling things about the Red Sox championship, which illustrates how much baseball has changed in a generation, is the Boston Red Sox won the World Series because of one player, Dave Roberts, a little-used player who was acquired from the Los Angeles Dodgers about two-thirds of the way through the season, stole second base against Mariano Rivera in, I think it was the eighth, it may have been the ninth inning of Game 4, with the Red Sox trailing. Roberts subsequently scored. Rivera melted down. The Yankees went on to lose after having a three-game lead. Without Dave Roberts winning, stealing second base, the Yankees win that World Series. Dave Roberts was traded 2 weeks ago by the Red Sox, and Orlando Cabrera, who was acquired two-thirds of the way through the season to replace the notoriously fickle Nomar Garcia-Parra, Cabrera sort of cemented the team psychologically as a shortstop who didn't have the stats that Garcia-Parra had, but who was great in the clubhouse and everybody liked him. He was shipped out last week. So it really just goes to show you that baseball is not, it's baffling to children, I think, to watch a thing where a guy's a hero for about 28 minutes and then he's traded.
Of course, the Olympic Games returned to Greece. This was an enormous event for Greece, but what do you remember about it?
That the Greeks took a bath. The Greeks just lost a fortune. The things that I remember most about it, because I hate amateur sports, particularly professional sports masquerading as amateur sports, which is largely what the Olympics are, the thing that I remember most about it was that the American baseball team didn't qualify for the Olympics, and that the American professional basketball team that was shipped over lost, and they stunk, and they were terrible. And that was probably the only thing that I remember about it. There was a lot of drug stuff. There was the whole thing where the judges couldn't get the score right, and then there was the question of whether this guy Ham was going to have to give his medals back or not. But I think that the Olympics should take off for a while. I think they should take like an 8-year hiatus and just give everybody a breather. And the Greeks just got hammered financially on this thing.
Lance Armstrong, of course, won his sixth consecutive Tour de France. Is he becoming the New York Yankees of bicycle racing?
Well, he had testicular cancer, so he recovered from that. So I think that there will always be a certain element of respect for him. You know, he's a long, tall Texan, and he's, you know, the French sort of whisper all the time about possible use of performance-enhancing drugs and things like that. But I think that basically he's viewed as one of the most amazing sportsmen, certainly of our times and probably of all times. It's quite a feat. Nobody has won the tournament as often as late in his career. as Lance Armstrong has, and nobody else, to my knowledge, ever won it after recovering from testicular cancer.
Joe Queenan, as always, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Joe Queenan's most recent book, Queenan Country, A Reluctant Anglophile's Pilgrimage to the Mother Country, and he joined us on the phone. In August, two prized Edvard Munch paintings, The Scream and Madonna, were ripped from the walls in broad daylight from the Edvard Munch Museum in Oslo, Norway. Roliv Solholm, the chief editor of the Norway Post, joined us earlier this year to try to explain what the possible motive might have been.
Theories range from tough guys trying to make a mark for themselves in certain circles to a tit-for-tat to the police for having fouled a armed robber, bank robbery the other night.
Mr. Solholm joins us now today with an update on this story. He's with us by phone from his home just outside of Oslo in Norway. Good to have you back.
Good evening, sir.
Any suspects arrested yet?
Well, there was one suspect held by the police in question just before Christmas. He claims to have an alibi for the Sunday in question in August when the paintings were stolen. But there is a theory, although the police doesn't want to say very much, that this man is suspected of having supplied the thieves with the car they used and possibly being the brain behind the theft.
Any ideas? Yeah. Any ideas about possible motive, since it's hard to sell these things?
Yeah, no, I haven't much to add to what I said last time on that. The police have been very careful, and they haven't wanted to say very much. The only thing they said at the time that this person was questioned was that they were confident that they would be able to solve the crime, but that they wouldn't want to say anything more than that.
What about the museum? Is it reopened?
No, that's another story. It'll be closed till at least until June next year. The city has decided to refurbish the whole museum as well as the security system at a cost of around $10 million.
Your clock's a minute fast.
Purposely.
Well, we'll let you get to whatever it is you need to get to. Roliv Solholm, thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome, sir. Bye-bye.
Roliv Solholm, chief editor of the Norway Post. He joined us by phone from his home just outside of Oslo in Norway. Now let's take on the rest of the cultural world, music, TV, theater, and, of course, movies. One film that made quite a splash at the box office this year was Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. Here are David Denby, a film critic for The New Yorker magazine, and Ramesh Ponnuru, a senior editor at The National Review, debating their views of the movie.
Here you have a movie that is essentially, after the preliminaries, about a handsome, strapping young man slowly tortured to death. And you see things in slow motion, blow after blow after blow.
I don't think it's sort of a perverse thing. I think it's a very, very purposeful. And in to my mind, if you are receptive to the message, at least, it works.
Joining us now with an overview of some big culture stories of the past year is Murray Horowitz, director and chief operating officer of the American Film Institute Silver Theater in Silver Spring, Maryland. He's also the former vice president of cultural programming here at NPR until he got a really good job. Murray, nice to have you back with us.
Good to be back, Neil. Thanks.
In movies, not just The Passion of the Christ, not exactly a big movie for Hollywood, but then you have Fahrenheit 9/11, a lot of small movies making big box office this
right.
year.
Right. This is famously the year of the upstart with The Passion of the Christ and Fahrenheit 9/11, both of which showed up on the, you know, top grossing films list. But as always, it's the big entertainment blockbusters that really made the most money. And I think one of the unsung stories of the year is movies, I don't say they were better than ever, but movies are very, very good this year. So that even those big blockbusters like, you know, Shrek 2 and Spider-Man 2 and The Incredibles, these were films that had some substance to them and were actually satisfying. And then there's a whole list of substantive films, including The Passion, including Fahrenheit 9/11 and other documentaries. Documentaries really started to enter the mainstream this year after having built up that pressure mm-hmm. for the last few years. But a real list of movies that, you know, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind and The Aviator and Ray and Sideways and The Woodsman and Hotel Rwanda, these are films with people trying to say something.
Mm-hmm. at the same time, there is a chill in the air, some suppression. Well, Janet Jackson, we mentioned the wardrobe malfunction.
You can't mention Janet Jackson without mentioning Justin Timberlake, Neil. It's equal time.
Equal time there. Well, it wasn't his wardrobe that malfunctioned.
No. He caused the malfunction.
But in any case, it's not just that, but the FCC has been cracking down on radio broadcasts and TV as well.
Yep, it's true. And I think, you know, the more I looked at this sort of survey of the cultural stories of the year, the more I realized that, as always, cultural events and activities were reflective of and rooted in, you know, the society as a whole, the economy and current events. And not surprisingly, we had some suppression issues, not so much First Amendment issues as commercial suppression. Linda Ronstadt had some concerts canceled because she had on stage endorsed Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11. You mentioned Janet Jackson, Justin Timberlake, Howard Stern. Just as the country was sort of polarized, this polarization made itself felt in some nasty and controversial stories.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a caller in. David is with us from Framingham, Massachusetts.
Yeah, hi, how are you today?
Okay.
I'd say the big entertainment cultural story of the year, it's sort of an ongoing story, is the kind of melding in an entertainment venue or sphere of reality with entertainment, reality in quotes, and I think you see it all over the place, and it's developing, you know, not just the reality TV shows, which are kind of a faux reality, the Queer Eye for the Straight Guy or Survivor or the Donald Trump thing, but you see that people are, you know, people still like their entertainment straight, but they're also ready to see things bust out from that frame. And you get the Michael Moore success with the 9/11. But you see it developing even further. The cultural impact of John Stewart's, you know, new Daily Show.
The fake news program.
At the very cutting edge of this, you see people like this brilliant comic, Ali G, creating these kind of
mock focus, interviews,
focus,
yeah.
Made up realities, which are also incredibly entertaining. It's a thing that's going to develop more and more, I think.
Mm-hmm. Reality spreading in all kinds of ways.
Yeah, right? I think
reality being the entertainment trying to play with and subvert the realities that we all have become, you know, formally comfortable getting.
I think that's true. I'd even go a little bit further. I mean, one of the things that we saw this year, and again, it's a trend that's been building, as the caller says, is a kind of changing aesthetic in popular culture. It's not so much the artist as a special talent with special skills up here to entertain you. More now you get the artist as proxy for the audience. Like, you know, it could just as well be you up here. I'm here as the embodiment of your fantasy. Mm-hmm. And that puts more emphasis on the offstage, off-screen persona, and that sort of thing. Reality TV actually sort of took a dip this year. It's down, but certainly not out.
Yeah, and you do have to say that the big surprise hit of the year, Desperate Housewives,
yep.
Scripted, funny.
Absolutely. I mean, the nighttime soap is back, folks.
David, thanks very much for the call, and Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you.
You might want to mention, too, though, that there has the decline of commercial TV has sort of continued. And one story that I think is really interesting is that with gadgets like TiVo, technology is changing our lives, and far fewer people are watching TV commercials than ever before. This became a big story in the industry this year, and it'll be interesting to see what the effects of it are.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Murray Horowitz at the moment as we review some of the big stories of 2004 in the arts. We're going to continue taking your calls, 800-989-8255, or send us email, TOTN@npr.org. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Murray, at the same time, you're also talking about sort of an undercurrent of despair in the fine arts. What do you mean by that?
I think that's something that, too, has been going on. But this year, there seems to be more desperation to the despair than ever before. You know, it's sometimes this undercurrent is not so under. There are dwindling audiences for things like classical music and serious theater. And despite people's efforts to put the very best face on it, in museums, there's even more emphasis now on the big blockbuster exhibit and sort of less adventurous art. One of the And so when you talk to people in the nonprofit arts sector, that whole section of symphony orchestras and opera companies and regional theaters and museums that we sort of grew up with in the 1950s and 60s and 70s and 80s is sort of gone now. There's no government funding or very little. And so things in the fine arts side are a little desperate.
Let's talk now with Giovanni. Giovanni's calling from Denver, Colorado.
Hi, I wanted to quickly go back and point out the irony that I see between the Janet Jackson wardrobe malfunction and the most famous TV show in America being Desperate Housewives right now. And I would hope that your guest could just talk to that a little bit.
Well, of course, one of the stars of Desperate Housewives then went on to the opening of Monday Night Football.
Right.
And I guess it wasn't a malfunction, but dropped her towel.
Right, exactly so. And again, I think that this... contradiction is, again, reflective of what's going on in society in a lot of ways. There was an item on NPR's Morning Edition that Renee Montaigne had at the bottom of the hour, one of her little shticks that she does going into the news, and she said, there was a county in Nevada where people voted for George Bush something like 85-15 and also voted to maintain legalized prostitution 70-30, something like that. And so this is America in 2004 and soon to be 2005.
Thanks for the call, Giovanni, and a Happy New Year to you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. We can't let you go, Murray. A couple of minutes on music. Rap music seems to be very much hot this year.
Yeah, hip-hop is still the dominant popular music form, and yet there are some really interesting little phenomena. The teen queens seem to be getting younger. I'm thinking of Hilary Duff here, who is, I guess if Britney Spears is in the descendant, Hilary Duff is in the ascendant. But seriously, there's a kind of cyclical return. The 1980s kind of became big again, and a revival of new wave, new wave music. For gosh sakes, Duran Duran made a new album this year, but also an interesting boomlet in the American popular song. George Gershwin, Cole Porter, Duke Ellington. There are a lot of particularly attractive young women coming out with CDs like that in the wake of Norah Jones. Queen Latifah has now just come out with an album of standards. There was a biopic with Kevin Klein about Cole Porter called The Lovely. And if you listen to American Idol, referring again to the caller's thing about reality and entertainment being blurred, you'll usually hear some of those classic American pop tunes.
Now, I'm not sure that Mac the Knife qualifies as the American songbook, but Bobby Darin is making a return to
that's
the theater.
That's
true. As well.
I once had to defend this because that was one of the NPR 100s. Nobody sings Und der Haifisch, er hat Zähne. Everybody sings The Shark Has Pretty Teeth, Dear. The one probably underreported phenomenon that I found that may be the most signal event in entertainment of the year is the fact that roughly 387 films were distributed in the United States this year, and Jude Law was in 425 of them.
Murray Horowitz, thank you very much, as always. Murray Horowitz, Director, Chief Operating Officer of the American Film Institute Silver Theater in Silver Spring, Maryland. He was with us here in Studio 3A. When we come back from a short break, NPR's very own Peter Sagal will take your calls on the year's top stories. Wait, go ahead and tell me after the break. This is NPR News. Today we're talking about the other stories from 2004, and in just a moment, Peter Sagal from NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me will answer your questions on some of his favorite stories of the year. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email us, TOTN@npr.org. But first, earlier this year, four hurricanes hit Florida in just one season. Charlie, Francis, Ivan, and Jean splintered many businesses, including homes in Punta Gorda, Florida. Chuck Cantasana was a postal worker there, and just 5 days after Hurricane Charlie demolished his house, he was back on the road delivering the mail. Chuck Cantasana, good to have you back on the program.
Thank you, Neil. It's good to be back.
How are things going?
Well, we are plugging along down here. We are still not back in our home. We've been a little over 4 months now living in a motorhome with work going on. Well, the longest part was the wait for the insurance settlements and the adjusters to come and all of that. But we've on most people have gotten past that or are near past that, and now the rebuild begins.
I assume the work at the post office is at least easier.
Neil, to be honest with you, you guys interviewed me, and within a day or two of that interview, I was working at the post office, and the post office is back up and running. I mean, it's been running all along, but I had an unfortunate, they brought in air conditioners to cool the tents that they had us working in, and and I slipped and fell on the water that the air conditioners let go, and ended up landing on my carcass bone and breaking my back.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that.
Yeah.
So you're out of I assume you're on workman's comp.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm on. Yeah. At this point, yeah. Just I was operated on a week ago Tuesday, and it seems to be alleviating it a little bit, although it's still pretty uncomfortable, and they still have me on meds pretty good.
And at the same time, with your house so damaged, where's all your stuff?
Well, we had, thank God, a friend was able to get us a tractor-trailer, which they brought the box and sat it next to the house. We emptied the house into the tractor-trailer so that no further water damage would be done to it, and that's where it all is. So,
any hope of getting the house fixed in the new year?
We're actually looking forward to getting. We hope to be in sometime the end of February, beginning of March, everything completed, at least enough to get back into our own bedrooms and get in there. We still may have kitchens and baths to finish the decorating and tile work, etc., but at least we'll be back in the house.
There's, I'm afraid, more than a few of your neighbors and other people in Florida in the same straits you are.
It's been an amazing experience down here, and you hear these stories from all, like what's going on with this tsunami and things. Boy, and I'll tell you, having gone through it here, it brings it to a whole new level. When you know, I can remember watching the TV, and you'd see hurricanes and twisters out west of floods, and you kind of just watched and said, oh, that's a shame. But boy, once you've been through it, and it brings it to a whole new level. And I mean, I other people have to feel like myself. We'd like to be of some help to those people over there, because when you think you're doing really bad, you hear about a situation like this with such an amazing loss of life and a total devastation, and you can understand what the survivors feel like that you couldn't have before you've lived through it.
Well, Chuck, we wish you. Look, 2005's got to be better, right?
I certainly am looking forward to it and hoping that it is. But I said that at the end of last year, and look what happened. So I'm hesitant to say anything.
Well, one thing after this interview, stay in bed for a couple of days till the crisis passes, and then.
We have to go. Really, the most frustrating thing is that you can't even walk around and pick up after the workers have left for the day. There's no bending, that type of thing. It's frustrating, but thank God, between my sons, myself, we've all teamed up. It was one of the most amazing things is where we would all get together and go to one. I have two boys who also had tremendous damage in their house, and we just took turns. We'd go to one's house and work there, and we'd go to the next one and clean up and just teamworked it. You know, thank God I had five boys and not five girls.
Well, Chuck Cantisano, thanks again, and good luck.
Thank you very much.
Chuck Cantisano joined us from his home in Florida. And here with us to wrap up the year 2004 is Peter Sagal, the host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. He's with us from our Chicago bureau. And, Peter, good to have you back on the show, as always.
Always a pleasure to be here, Neil.
And as you look back over the stories that your show covered this year, did you notice any kind of a theme?
Well, I did. I went back and I looked at the archives of Wait, Wait in our vault, and I, you know, started by looking, oh, what was our, you know, best story about, say, a dumb criminal? But I noticed an odd trend, which is at the beginning of the year, we covered stories on our show which seemed to predict the way the news was going to go for the rest of the year. That's clear, of course, in hindsight.
Uh-huh. Well, what about the presidential election?
For example. Now, there was a lot of speculation as to how it would go. People, pollsters, were arguing about it right up to the very day and through the day. All I think they really needed to do was to go back to January of this last year, when we covered a story from the Boston Globe which noted that John Kerry had adopted a new tactic to try to appeal to more people. He had started to drop his G's at the end of his present participles while he was out, for example, campaigning and canvassing. This was a strategy on behalf of the campaign. I think that's all you really needed to know, politically speaking. Don't you? His fortune.
I suspect that may have said, well, you've also noted that this didn't last.
No, it didn't. I mean, as early as a month later, in regard to some questions about his military record, he noted with some pride that he had been thrice wounded in Vietnam. Thrice wounded. When he was fighting there, you know. I mean, what more do you need to know about the poor guy in terms of his ability to pass himself off to the American public?
Does this pattern extend to, example, we all saw this year, the departure of Secretary of State or impending departure of Secretary of State Colin Powell?
Well, we were covering all kinds of snarky stuff that was being said about him and for him in terms of his acolytes in the State Department that indicated you know, months before the fact that he'd be leaving the post if the president won re-election. But again, all we needed to do to find out who would replace him was pay attention to a story that we picked up back in March, again early in the year. Condoleezza Rice was at a dinner party in New York City, and she referred to President Bush as my husband. Actually, technically, she referred to him as my husb, because she caught herself. It was like, my husb, I mean, President Bush said the other night, which is weird in Condoleezza Rice's case because, of course, she's never been married. So it's not as if it's like, oh, you know, you're thinking of one person, you mention another. There is no husband. So again, her continued elevation to a position of trust came as no surprise to people paying attention to the right kind of news.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get a caller on the line. Kurt is with us from southern New Jersey.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Can you hear me on a cell phone? It's not that good.
We can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay, good. One story that I heard on NPR, I guess 2 or 3 months ago, concerned skeletons in Indonesia that were found of some very small statured people. And that seemed like an amazing revelation, but I haven't heard anything about it since. Did that turn out to be a hoax, or is it the real thing, or...
No, we, if I may, Neil, we actually covered that on our show. It was a discovery of a race of apparently tiny people who lived many, many thousands of years ago. And immediately, despite all best efforts to stop them, the archaeological community started referring to them as hobbits.
Yeah, so did I. Hard to avoid.
I know you want to stop doing it, but you can't help it.
I did read a subsequent follow-up which said that these, of course, were discovered on an Indonesian island by a joint Indonesian and Australian team that apparently were looking for something else when they found these bodies. And then the most prominent archaeologist or anthropologist or a prominent Indonesian scientist who chuffed at this discovery suddenly arrived on the island and whisked these skeletons back to the capital. So we may hear more about this in the future.
What was great, of course, was the reaction of some leading archaeologists in New York at the National Museum who said, if I may quote them, aw.
That's like it might be an Area 51 type of thing.
Well, we don't want to get too far ahead of Ira and his science review tomorrow. But, Kurt, thanks very much for the call.
Thanks for taking my call. Bye-bye.
And Happy New Year to you.
Yes, Happy New Year to you, too.
We're talking about some of the... uncovered and reduced stories from 2004. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Peter Sagal is with us from our bureau in Chicago. Peter, what about people in the news this year?
Well, for us, I mean, the story that we were following with enthusiasm until it became actually kind of painful to watch in the manner of a car crash was, of course, the public disintegration of Britney Spears going from, you know, premier Pop-Tart to, well, tart. Again... We could have been able to predict exactly what would happen based on an early news story. I refer, of course, to her January marriage, 50 hours long, to her childhood friend Jason Alexander in Las Vegas. She, of course, has subsequently married a much more upstanding person. But what was great about that first marriage story, the detail that I just loved, was that according to an interview that Mr. Alexander, the former Mr. Spears, gave to a British tabloid, he was describing the aftermath of this whirlwind day or two in Las Vegas when he was married. Mm-hmm. And he got a phone call from one of Britney's relatives who was concerned about these developments and raised the prospect of an annulment. And Mr. Alexander told the tabloid that he chose to say nothing in response to this suggestion because he didn't know what the word annulment meant.
He found out.
He found out, yes, he found out rather quickly in a firsthand way. We eventually averted our eyes from Miss Spears out of pity and sadness.
Well, it's so sad when such a distinguished artist, you know, reaches her peak and then, well, it's all downhill from
here. It's terrible. It's like what happened to Verlaine in some way, don't you think?
I think so, yes. You mentioned earlier that your show has a specialty in covering dumb criminals.
Well, it is. That's something we can't really help it. It was a kind of greatness that was forced upon us because it turns out that the criminal class of America and internationally, not that bright. Which may explain their choice of career. Our favorite story of dumb criminals from the year came, and I can't explain quite why, it came from Kansas City, where police arrested a serial bank robber. He had robbed 3 banks quite successfully and probably would have gotten away with it. But police, in raiding his home, found a to-do list. And on the to-do list was the item, rob bank.
Well, that should be his defense. Nobody ever does anything that's on their to-do list.
Exactly. And I think it's a case of admiration for this guy. We both find his downfall and his strength. He was organized. Too organized.
Let's get another caller on the line. Helen is with us from St. Louis.
Yes. I just was wondering, why is it that the East Coast seems to rule the news? For example, earlier Joe Queenan was talking about the Boston Red Sox winning the World Series, and although I am a St. Louis Cardinals fan to the end, I take my hat off to them, and I'm very happy for them, but there was no mention of the Cardinals. It was only the Red Sox and the Yankees. And so I was wondering why you think that is, that in spite of the fact that the Cardinals were playing in the World Series, there was no mention of them.
One could be cruel and point out they didn't play very hard.
Well, I agree they did not play too well. However, I just think that they should at least have been mentioned.
Peter, are you there clutching your Cubs hat?
No, actually, this is actually true. I am a transplant to Chicago. I am a Red Sox fan. In fact, I am wearing my Red Sox sweatshirt
front runner
as I speak to you. Yes, I know. And I just have one reaction to this poor woman, which is, St. Louis has a baseball team? How good for you! Is this a recent expansion? No, I'm sorry. There was a wonderful article in the New York Times about the St. Louis fans. And it said, to your credit, that you all are astonishingly nice people.
Notice, Helen, he only read it because it was in the New York Times.
Exactly. And it was about a team the Red Sox were about to play. But nonetheless, I mean, it did describe you folks, you St. Louis fans, as just being the kindest, most forgiving people that you could imagine, and how lovely it was, and you appreciated your team no matter what happens. And I think that in terms of drama requires conflict. Drama requires angst and pain and misery.
And requires being cut off. Helen, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
I just wanted to leave time. You've got 40 seconds, Peter, for your couple of the year.
My couple of the year has to be a married couple from Wisconsin who this year had the novel experience of being attacked, shot at by their own oven. They went on vacation. The husband decided he needed a dry, safe place to put his guns and ammo. He chose the oven. They returned from vacation. He neglected to tell his wife of his choice of a safekeeping. She started dinner. The rest was chaos. But fortunately, they were not hurt, so they were able to enjoy this honor from me.
Peter Sagal, thank you so much, as always, for being with us, and we look forward to another great year of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
So do I, Neil. Thank you so much.
Peter Sagal joined us from our bureau in Chicago. He is the host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. In Washington, Happy New Year, everybody. I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.